From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? And with me this week, as always, the other half of the Goal Own Goal. I like to think of him as a human own goal, and I'll be the human goal. The one and only Roger Mitchell. Yeah. Roger, how are you, mate?
I'm actually feeling a little bit like an own goal this week. I've had a cold and nothing worse than that, thankfully, but a little bit under the weather. But raring to go for this, so I think we've got some beauties to discuss this week, Grant.
Good man. You're sounding a lot better. When I spoke to you in the week, you sounded awful. You're sounding a lot better now.
Yeah. A lot better. And of course, you know, Goal on Goal, we only do once a month because of all the other shows. And there's so much to catch up on. It's really difficult to get your choices narrowed down, I must admit.
Well, I'm gonna take that as my cue to let you go first, so that if we run out of time, you get an extra one in. So away you go.
Okay, well, this one here is, at the end of the day, after all my analysis of what I could have chosen, this one is the standout winner, and there's two reasons for that. One is a sporting reason, and one is a sports business reason. And I'm talking about India-Australia Test Series. I don't know if you followed that at all. I know cricket's not your biggest thing.
I'm not a huge cricket fan, but I've been following England. India this week, but I haven't seen anything about India Australia. So enlighten me.
Well, this was a full test series that had everything, and as I say, I'll start from the sporting stuff that I think is really worth getting into. The Indian captain Kohli, the very very famous batsman and captain, left at the start of the season on paternity leave.
That's right. Yes, that I do remember.
And that was very controversial. You know, there was a lot of criticism back in India from people like Gavaskar. You know, there was another bowler, if I'm not mistaken, who wasn't allowed to go back for the same reason. And it got into that whole Indian, like anywhere in the world. But, you know, India is a huge country. And I think sometimes we make a mistake of thinking it is one holistic nation, whereas it's a whole lot of very, very different regions. And, you know, all...
Well, Roger, what I would say for people listening to this that don't know much about cricket is that there is one thing in India where it is holistic, and that is cricket. So there'll be people listening to this thinking, what, someone wasn't allowed to go on paternity leave? But cricket is... I mean, it is a religion in India. It's extraordinarily popular, and the fans are extraordinarily rabid. It's such a huge deal. So I think it's important to set that table for people that don't understand just what a big thing it is.
But even there, you know, Gavaskar comes out and says, you know, Kohli shouldn't have done that. He should be putting nation, to your point, Grant, he should be putting nation ahead of family, and cited a whole lot of previous cricketers from other generations who had done that. And Kohli is married to a Bollywood actress. And
of course he is.
As you would expect. And she wasn't quiet on this and, you know, made comments about this is the usual Mumbai cricketing fraternity. And you know, I wouldn't not say that I know this in detail, but it certainly alluded to the fact that, you know, when you scratch under the surface a little bit, there's intense rivalries, as you would expect in a country that size.
Yeah.
So he leaves and basically the captain's gone, the main batsman, the superstar's gone. And gets worse, you know, they are plagued with injuries and, you know, are basically fielding a second 11. I mean, seriously, not two or three out. I mean, almost the whole team out. They get whacked in the first test. They managed to get a draw. And then, you know, in the fourth test, I might be wrong, but I think it was the fourth test, they did this rear guard action of defending to run out of time. And, you know, the tail-enders were classically, you know, managing to hang on against some very hostile bowling, which in itself was wonderful entertainment. And then that takes you to the Gabba for the deciding test. And, you know, they've got a big target to chase in the last test. And, you know, they go for it, especially under the name of the wicketkeeper, I think he is, Pant, who's a young lad, who basically, in the most enthralling way, got them over the line to win the test. Now, first thing is that I don't think anybody has won at the Gabba, certainly not India, for many, many years. We're talking
about, that's right, yeah.
You know, and, yeah. And like, I saw a stat about this guy himself that scoring heavily like he did 90, 100 in the fourth innings whilst winning or saving a test, it's only been done a couple of times, and the people that have done it are the pantheon of Indian cricket, Gavaskar, Tendulkar, Ganguly. So this guy, Pant, you know, really does something incredibly, incredibly heroic, and the excitement is amazing, amazing. And of course, everybody gets on the back of that, and Modi and everything like that, a great thing for India, for our nation. Then there was a whole backlash against Kohli, and, you know, we don't need you anymore. The usual kind of stuff you get on social media these days. And I just thought, you know, one of the things I want to say to you, Grant, is that for some reasons, and this is like kind of widening the conversation a little bit, I'm very attracted to India as what you would call one of the challenger powers, if there's only two of them, them and China. I just feel India attracts me a lot more. You know, their diversity, their spirituality. You know, if their guy is Gandhi and the Chinese one is Mao Zedong, you know, like, you know which one you're going to go for. I just keep getting a sensation that India is going to be much more successful than we give credit for. And I think we saw a little bit of that today, in these recent days. And, you know, then you start thinking, you know, well, what happened here? What really happened? You know, they lost their captain. They really had a second team and they pulled it off. And you start thinking about captains. Well, I did anyway. You know, we had our competitor, the splendid Richard Gillis, on our podcast at one point. You know, he wrote that book, The Captain's Myth. You know, mm-hmm. You may remember that. And you know, I'm starting thinking, you know, is Kohli really the right captain? You know, because the guy that replaced him did a magnificent job. And I'm just thinking, should it really be that Kohli should be told, a little bit like Botham was, like, you just do your thing and leave captaincy to somebody else. And you know, then you look at Tim Payne, who had an awful series, massively criticised, and you start thinking, what's the role of the captain in cricket? And I just thought this was, from the sporting point of view, a really excellent goal. And, you know, there's other things that I want to say about that and reflections I've had, but what's your view? What's your view about India and the role of cricket? You said it's a religion. Are we underestimating the importance of this game going forward?
Well, you know, it's actually a very good question, Roger. Not something I've spent an awful lot of time thinking about. But, you know, I've been to India. I've in my former day job, I've been trying to invest in the Indian stock market, which was an interesting and a bunch of stories for another day. And look, India has its challenges, and most of those challenges revolve around bureaucracy, which is extraordinary and makes it very difficult to get anything done in India. You know, there's plenty of corruption in India. There are all kinds of problems which you would expect in a nation of that size. If India ever did find a way to get its act together, then I absolutely agree with you. I mean, there's been, just in my career, the last sort of 30 years, there's been several false dawns where people thought this was it. This was going to be the change in India. And I would love to see that change. Me I would too. Love to see India compete as a world power on the level that it should, but it does have an awful lot of things that it needs to sort out, not least religion. You know, cricket is the one kind of secular religion in India, but obviously aside from that, you've got plenty of others. And as I said, the layers of bureaucracy are extraordinary in India, and that goes back to the, you know, the times of the Raj back there, back in the sort of 50s, 40s and 50s. But this question about captains, I find a very interesting one, Ross, because it's the same dynamic that you see in business, right? Let's take our most 100%. Successful salesman and make him head of the sales team. No, don't do that. He's a salesman. He doesn't want to manage people. Let's take our most successful batsman and make him captain. No, why do you want to, you know, just, but the crowd want the big name to be the captain. And the big name wants to be the captain because who doesn't grow up as an Indian kid dreaming of captaining the Indian cricket team? Who doesn't grow up dreaming of captaining the England football team? You know, it's a dream. So it's, I'd love to know if anyone's ever turned it down because they said, well, you know, it'll affect my performance. I bet you, you'd be hard pushed to find anyone who did that. And the Botham analogy is absolutely right, Rog. You know, here's a guy who was by far England's best and most charismatic player and had a horrendous time when he was captain. And you take the captaincy off his shoulders and that Boom. Very next test back in 81, out he comes. It's the old Botham. So, you know, I think this conflating your best player or with being a captain is, it's understandable and you get why it happens. But I just think, particularly in cricket, it's not so much of a big thing in football. I don't think it matters so much in football, to be honest. And no, except at international level. I'm talking club captains,
even
whatever.
There, Grant. You know, I think we said it on the podcast with Richard. I actually am a big believer in captaincy and leadership, and I agree with you 100%. It's the same in companies.
Well, but leadership. Hang on, but hang on, Rog. Leadership and captaincy are two different things, I think.
Really?
I think you can have a captain of a football team, but you look around the side and you can see there are other leaders in that team.
Sure.
I think you can lead without being a captain. And I think that's the problem, is that you don't necessarily make your best leader your captain. And that is the difference. You know, someone like Roy Keane, who embodied both, right? Here's a guy who is a leader and a captain. But, you know, someone like David Beckham, it's a different kind of leadership. But here he was, England captain, when he had people like, you know, Frank Lampard and Rio Ferdinand in that team. Yeah,
he wasn't the best captain, you're right.
He wasn't the best captain, but that's not to say he didn't lead by example. I mean, nobody worked harder than Beckham, but he wasn't the best captain, I don't think, for that team. So I think there is a distinction. I think it's an important one.
It's very interesting, and I think you do make a good distinction. Cricket's maybe slightly different because of all the whole tactics and everything like that.
Where, there's a lot more pressure on a cricket.
You know, another example in India was with Tendulkar, who I think was probably universally considered a dreadful captain, although he was just, you know, he was, I mean, like world class, you know, like, not dreadful. I mean, like, in fact, I may be wrong, but I think he himself said, look, you know, I'm not the right guy for this. And he gave it to Ganguly. And then they took off. You know, I think the captaincy, it will be really interesting to see, and we'll come on to the England India in a minute. It'll be really interesting to see if Kohli doesn't win the first test. And, you know, Raheem did really well there. And there'll be a lot of calls back to Kohli to just say, look, just step down, mate. And now he won't do that. But, you know, that's what I think is coming round the corner.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's funny you talk about this. This takes me to my first goal, which is Joe Root's performance in the first test, England versus India. You know, here's a guy who is a remarkable batsman. To score 100 in your 100th test is there any better sporting achievement than that? I mean, that's up there with the very pinnacle of the sport, I would think, in terms of personal achievements. To run it up to 218 last I saw he was, is just phenomenal. And so, you know, watching this England cricket team who've kind of had some ups and downs over the last couple of years, watching Stokes take apart the Indian spinners. And the best part of this, and this is why it was the goal, is that this is being shown on Channel 4 in the UK. It's been shown on terrestrial TV.
That's right.
And we saw that with the World Cup last year.
That was my sports biz part of it. On you go, mate. We're thinking exactly the same. You fire away.
Yeah, so you know, last year we had the World Cup in England and it was shown on terrestrial TV and it gave cricket a huge shot in the arm. Now, it didn't hurt the fact that it was so exciting. That finish in the World Cup final remains one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen on any kind of sporting field. But to have this test also on terrestrial TV, particularly under lockdown, when everyone's sitting at home, what better thing to do when you're locked in all day than to sit down and spend the entire day watching cricket on TV. So they've served up a fantastic performance for a captive crowd. That's as big a crowd as they could have in the UK because it's not on satellite TV. So I just think this is a huge positive for cricket. And I'm delighted to say that cricket isn't a game that I grew up playing. I played it a little bit at school, but it wasn't my first or second sport. But I love to watch a good England cricket match. I wouldn't watch the county stuff. And the highlights I've seen of this India-England test match have been extraordinary.
Mm. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. It was going to be my continuation of this because I think it's absolutely seminal. You know, my own history with cricket, you know, believe it or not, I was very, very passionate about cricket. And, you know, when I was at university, all the summer tests were perfect. And, you know, I got very much into it. I loved, you know, the way cricketers carried themselves and, you know, that kind of swagger that you got from a Malcolm Marshall or an Imran Khan or Viv, you know, and you know, a David Goward, both of them. I just loved all of that. And then for some reason, well, not for some reason, I left the country. I went to Italy and obviously had no exposure to cricket. But I mean, even if I had stayed, you know, cricket went behind the paywall, I think, around about 2025. And I think that is the kind of like case study, Harvard Business School's case study about should you go behind the paywall? And you know, we won't revisit your own thing with your own business, Grant, but it's so, so germane these days to be talking about this. And the fact that Channel 4 has taken this, and okay, there's a little bit maybe of opportunism, but it's just fantastic. And you know, there's a second leg to why I think this is seminal. The IPL, you know, these young Indian cricketers, they're grown up now in the IPL and they're not afraid of test cricket. The IPL's a wonderful property. And, you know, Channel 4 bought these rights, I think, off of Disney. I think it's Star that's the subsidiary out there.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Channel 4 don't have them exclusively. I know there's people that look at this stuff more in detail than me, but I think it's non-exclusive. And, you know, the talk is that IPL and cricket is going to be the cornerstone property for the Disney Plus launch in the UK and maybe wider and globally. And, you know, all this talk over these years about Netflix of sport and who is it and does it. I'll tell you who it is. It's bloody Disney Plus. And I think it's based on cricket, which and in terms of numbers is the biggest sport in the world. And, you know, I think we are about to see, thanks to India, cricket being the absolute poster child of everything that's going to change in our industry.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I hadn't connected those dots, but yeah, look, it makes sense. I mean, cricket is, if you want a game that can reach, you know, the most populous places on earth, it's cricket. There's no doubt about it.
No doubt.
I mean, this is, and as to our earlier point, it's an extraordinarily strong connection between the audience and the game. I mean, this is life and death for these people. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, you play test cricket in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, it's unbelievable to see the scenes. And it's tough if you're a poor team. I mean, I can't even imagine the pressure that's on them. But in terms of what you say with regards to Disney, it makes perfect sense to me, Roger. I hadn't really thought about it, but it's a really good point.
Yeah, I think, you know, the days of selling sports rights geographically are ending. And I'm talking about premium end, obviously. And this is a whole polarization about what I think are sports rights that can go global and hence will be sold global, and ones that are regional and hence will be sold regional. Cricket is going to take us forward. The other thing that cricket, I don't think, has got enough credit for over the years, and again is the poster child, is that I don't think there's been any other sport that's messed around with changing formats to attract new audiences the way cricket has. You know, with first the one days, then T20, and now we've got the 100. I just, you know, as I say, when I was choosing what to talk about today, and I just thought about all of these things, and this has to be the goal. You know, we are seeing in front of our eyes through this, the India-England test, the launch of Disney Plus, all of these things, I think we are seeing the migration of a sports industry right in front of our eyes.
Yeah, no, it's a really, really good point, Roger, and it's certainly something to watch. I think it's coming. You can tell it's coming, but it's funny how circumstance sometimes accelerates these things, right? Which is you just get this perfect storm where terrestrial TV gets it. You get a thrilling match. Now, the last time England played there in India, I seem to remember they scored 477 odd in the first innings. I thought they had India on the rack. India declared at 750, yeah. I think, and went on to beat England by an innings. So, again, that's the beauty of Indian cricket pitches. The twists and turns of the game are crazier there than just about anywhere else in the world.
That in itself is interesting, coming back to what I said when I was looking at this at the 80s. You know, India was a certain, I would have thought, a one-dimensional team, you know. But now, and again, I think the IPL has got a lot to do with this. Now, India have got a team that can play on all surfaces, Grant. You know, they've got beautiful fast bowlers. They can obviously spin it. They've got beautiful batters. And they're at home. And, you know, I don't have a lot of hope for England over this test series, because India will produce the pitches that they want at will. And I just think they will drive this home with relative ease.
Well, you say that. Watching Stokes take the spinner apart today was
they'll adjust. They'll change the pitches.
But England are definitely underdogs. There's no doubt they're underdogs. Yeah. But you never know. That's the beauty of sport, right?
Yeah. So what have you got? That, I guess that was your goal. So what about own goal? What have you got for us?
Well, it's an own goal and a goal mixed into one, and I'm going to go back to golf. And this the report, the Distance and Insights report, that was published by the USGA and the RNA this past week.
Yeah.
Basically talking about how they need to now change. They're going to restrict the length of the driver to 46 inches from 48 at the Masters and the Open. And there's talk about the ball being changed to counter the Bryson DeChambeau effect. Now, the first person to have commented on it was DeChambeau, saying, "I don't care, it doesn't bother me." And of course, it shouldn't, because this is a relative thing, right? This is a relative thing. He's still going to be longer than everybody else.
Yeah.
He's still going to be hitting shorter clubs in. You're gonna punish him and make him play a 6-iron instead of a 8-iron into certain greens. But everybody else is going to be hitting 4-iron. No, it does. But everyone else is hitting 4-iron. So, but what was interesting was Rory McIlroy's comments. You know, he came out after this, and you know, he's one of the most high profile golfers in the world, and he basically piled in and said, "Look, you spent an awful lot of time and money on this study, money that could have been spent in the grassroots of the game," which I totally agree with. The 0.1% of the golfing world, which is the pros, is all this is really going to affect. You know, what are you doing? If you don't need to do a big study over this. Yes, you can tell that the pros are now hitting. Bryson hit a 423-yard drive at Muirfield Village last year. You know that there's a problem there, but it's such a tiny percentage of the game. He said, "Do whatever you want to us. He said, if you want to make it harder for us, that's fine by me. You know, if you want to make it the game more skillful at the top level, then absolutely do that, because it ultimately weeds out the better players, and McIlroy obviously being one of those, it plays into his hands. But I think he's absolutely right. There's an awful lot of time, money, and effort going into figuring out how the pros change the game of golf, when the reality is they really don't that much. And until you get the average drive of the weekend hacker 350 yards, you don't need to change these golf courses at all. It's not such a big conversation to have, if you ask me. Change it for the pros and leave it the same for everybody else.
That's an interesting
you as a big hitter, obviously this is slightly more nuanced for you, I'd imagine.
No, listen, I think you touched on something there that I don't agree with Rory on, and for once in my life I'll back up the rights holder who's done the study and everything like that. You know, there's a whole lot of federations, you know, even the English FA, they've come out again with their strategy plan and, you know, grassroots. It's all bollocks. You know how you get sports to grow? You get a superstar that attracts kids to do the same. Bjorn Borg and tennis in Sweden. you know, German golfers, Bernard Langer, all of that. You know, so the only thing about fostering and getting participation at young levels, of the sport, is to get the superstars doing something that kids find aspirational. And that's why I think it is important that, you know, we don't let it just become a kind of like long driving competition. I think Rory's wrong in that, and I think they do well to maybe look at these areas, because that the top of the game is what attracts the bottom of the game. And I'll give you one more little example for comment, because I know you probably won't take my view on this. Did you see Bubba Watson and his kind of like showmanship this week, Grant?
No, I didn't see that.
I don't know where he was, you know, because I just saw it on the feed and the timeline, and there's a couple of videos. He's in some place where there's very, very loud crowd. I think it may have been Asia. And the first one, he's in a par three, and he takes his driver and plays a dinky wee shot. I think this may have been the exhibition or the pro-am bit of it at the start. And he puts it on the green and he's hooping it up and high-fiving and everything like that. And then I saw another clip where he's in a bunker, and then these two, I don't know, caddies or supporters come into the bunker and they do a wee dance routine.
I did see.
And like, I'm thinking, oh, Grant's going to hate this, you know? And you know, it's for me, you know my line by now. For me, this is really important. You know, you have to make these stars approachable and aspirational, and that's why I think that coming back to the distance thing is important. You know, golf, everybody says they had a good COVID and never been better, and I know you and Giles are going to do a special and all of this. I just believe that golf still needs to do more of the stuff that we saw Bubba Watson doing, and getting people really excited about what's going on.
Yeah, I saw that thing with Bubba. I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was great. And I'm not disagreeing that there's a place for that. And I think you'll struggle to do more of that in and around the tournament itself. So it'll be social media stuff. They take themselves very seriously. But you know, Giles and I have had conversations with some of the top administrators in the game for this golf special we're going to do shortly. And you know, it's interesting when you look at what's happening with the European Tour. They do have a remarkable crop of young players who are not just extremely talented, but also very approachable and very happy to laugh at themselves. I don't know if you saw
the
anger management, yeah. The anger management thing, right? Which was fabulous.
It was great.
I mean, it was just so great to see those guys making fun. And it followed through. I don't know if you saw in the tournament itself.
Oh, yeah. He thumbs Tyrrell up, Hatton, yeah.
Tyrrell Hatton, yeah. when he sliced his drive, just did that thumbs up. It's fabulous. You know, that stuff is just great.
I think
there is a way, if you do it right, and the European Tour definitely seem to be doing it right, that you can weave this stuff into the game proper without it becoming kitschy and gimmicky and forced and done for the sake of that. I think the European PGA Tour have done a great job with it. I think the US PGA Tour are a little further behind, simply because I think the mentality over there is much more insular. I don't think they have the camaraderie that the European players have, and that's been the same since the 80s, right? That's why the Ryder Cup turned around, because the Europeans just had that camaraderie. But it's coming. You know, you've got young players also in America. Who similarly are fun and have a lighter side and like goofing around outside the tour. But over there, you're under so much more scrutiny, as we saw with the recent Justin Thomas situation. And I think the problem is, if you're a governing body, if you're the European Tour or the PGA Tour, and you're trying to encourage these guys to be more approachable, then you have to be very, very careful about things like the incident with Justin Thomas, right? Because if you want them approachable, that means you're going to have more mics. You're going to have you are going to bring in human fallibility, and I think that's extraordinarily unfair for these guys to expect them to be entertainers, to expect them to give off themselves in candid moments, and then in those candid moments, if they say one word, which, you know, it does that tell you who he is? It absolutely doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. It's a curse word that he dropped in the heat of the moment, and we've seen what happened since then.
Yeah.
So I think there's a very, very fine balancing act.
No, there is.
And,
well, if it was easy, everybody could do it, Grant. It's going to be tough.
No, but I think way too much is expected of the players in this environment where these little cutesy things that you talk about are what everybody wants. I think they have to be protected, and you have to be able to stand up for these guys. Someone needs to stand up at the top level and say, listen, you want access to these guys. We're going to give it to you, but you have to be forgiving if every now and then there's a slip. But I don't think we live in a culture where that's possible. So I it'd be interesting to see how it goes, Rog. But I haven't seen what happened to JT. I'd be a lot more worried about allowing microphones in those candid moments as a golfer.
Yeah. Listen, this takes exactly a great segue onto what I call my own goal, but it could have been a goal as well. But it's the same theme, and I think we need to talk about it a little bit. And I'm not going to go into, you know, all of these, like, we've covered that enough. And what I'm talking about is the memification of the world. And obviously on this podcast, I'm going to talk about the memification of sport. We saw last week, and you would know this more than anybody else, Grant, you know, the memes that came around the, you know, GME, and, you know, how the Gen Z and Robin Hood crowd could create funny memes to get others to what seemed a simple thing, invest in stocks and push it to the skies, and it become entertainment in itself. The meme in this case was, why spend $250,000 on a Harvard MBA? Just get on Robin Hood and we'll show all these people. Do you know what I mean? This is becoming, Grant, a phenomenon that I think a lot of our generation and a lot of society in general is underestimating, the memification of the world. I'm going to give you an example here, and I'm going to keep it relatively lighthearted, I hope. You heard of the name Jan Bednarek? Bednarek?
Say, yes, I have. Yes, yes. I can't think where, but I am familiar with the name.
He's a Southampton player.
Yes, that's right. Yes, 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 yes.
Right. He became a meme this week. The reason he became a meme is that on fantasy football, he got the worst score possible, which is a -7. And then own goal, penalty, and got sent off. He got the triple crown, right? That's a record. Now, you may not be familiar with this, but in fantasy football, there's something called triple captain, which means whoever you allocate your captain gets treble the points that they score. So if you've got -7, you actually got -21. Right. And that's obviously, if you're playing the game seriously, that's dramatic. You know, like -21 kills your season. But that's not the point. You know, like I obviously spend some time discussing fantasy with my son now. And, you know, we were laughing about this because the memes about somebody, maybe two people, actually did triple captain Jan, you know, and, you know, the laughs and everything like that. And I said to my son, I said, yeah, but who in God's name decides to take the risk to triple captain a defender of Southampton? You know, that triple captain thing, you only get it once a season, and it is a joker card that you have to play with utmost judgment. So he replies to me, says, they're playing for the meme, Grant. They're playing for the meme. And I said, what does that mean? He says, well, if you go for an outlier thing like that and it comes off, you're the king. And I said, what? He said, yeah. I mean, like, these kids are smart. He says, there's 8 million people that play the Fantasy League in the English Premiership. He says, probably only 5 are about doing it seriously. The other 3 have got fake accounts and they're playing for the meme. They're making silly bets that if they come off, will get them a certain element of notoriety. And, you know, that, if you look at what goes on in football today, both played football or fantasy or all the stuff that happens, you know, around managers or transfers, it's all done on memes, and they are incredibly imaginative. They are immediate and they are incredibly entertaining. And I think, you know, I wanted to link that to what we saw in the stock market. You know, I know you don't like this, Grant, but I honestly think people are not seeing how big a phenomenon this is now.
Okay, well, so let's talk about that a bit, Rog. This, yeah, in the stock market, a friend of mine, Dimitri Kofinas, who has a fabulous podcast called Hidden Forces, talks about this, and we'll get to sport in a second. Let's talk about the financial
side. This is the key of today.
He talks about financial nihilism, right? This idea that you've got nothing to lose, and so what's the point? You may as well just mess around with this stuff. We've got people putting their stimulus checks, you know, people who need this money to feed their families, and they're gambling it on stocks, right? Because they see the stocks are going up for reasons way too technical for this podcast, but people are jumping on the bandwagon, and it's going up. And people would rather throw their money at the meme stock than feed their family in the hope of, you're right, in this time, they're not looking for the notoriety, or they want to be part of that notoriety, but it's the, I want to hit the home run. I want to turn my $1,200 into $1 million, right? And there are people out there on YouTube with their cutesy videos showing me that they can do it. So if they can do it, I can do it. And of course, what happens, right? The stock, GameStop, that they're all piling into falls 80% in a week. And all these people who were late to the party have been cleaned out and have lost 85% of their stimulus money, or, you know, whatever they've put in there. You know, there are always the people that these things crush. And it's always been the same. You know, with sport, Rog, again, it's a similar phenomenon, but you and I have talked about this before, but this idea of being the king of the meme, I get it, but it's instantaneous and it's forgotten because there's another meme coming along in 10 minutes' time.
Yeah, I get that, Grant.
I get it. And it's fun, right? If you want to do that and that's your aim, you're doing it just for a laugh. And maybe one day it comes off and you can shout about how you had the worst possible score. Great, I got no problem with that. If that's what you want to do, go for it. Have fun. My problem is what you are doing is conditioning everybody to basically not care about anything past tomorrow.
Past the meme.
And doing that by its very definition, making all people care about is the meme, is crazy because the timeline of these memes is getting shorter and shorter and shorter.
They are, yeah.
So you are conditioning people to try desperately to be popular, to have notoriety, whatever it may be, for a moment in time. And forget Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame. We're talking 15 seconds of fame here. And is it really fame, Rog? Are you really achieving anything apart from gratification in your own world where you feel like the king of that world, which is great? But if you think about what constitutes fame in terms of what, or notoriety, whatever it is that these guys think they want, what constitutes that? Is it one brief moment? And if it is, you and I both know that if you scored a hat trick in the final when you were 18, you can live off that for the rest of your life,
yep,
right? Because your mate saw you score the hat trick in the final. If you happen to be the subject of that one meme in December 2020, are you going to remember that? How long is that going to be remembered?
No, your point
for?
I would is argue, 100%, Grant. What I'm trying to discuss here is the effects of this. You know, it's, you know, let's not solve the problems of the world the way they would like them to be, but the way they are. And you know, on this podcast, we talk about the challenges of sport and fandom and everything like that. And I'm putting on the table the fact that if you're running a sports content business, if you're thinking about anything to do with fan engagement, you better be an expert on memes. You better have your organization set up to react, produce, and monetize as much as possible this phenomenon, because this is, I think it's everything. I mean, I'll give you, I said in a previous podcast, I'm not sure Frank Lampard would be gone if it wasn't for the memes around there. You know, if you look at Mourinho now, you took Mourinho 6 weeks ago, there was a whole lot of, you know, the special one stuff coming around. Really, I mean, again, all of these things are super creative. It's not nonsense, silly insults. It's like super creative stuff. And now, you know, 6 weeks later and he's having a hard time. And again, that is what is driving the agenda. And, you know, I just think a lot of us, you know, dismiss them in the way you've said, because you're right, it's a fake, it's fugazi, it's nothing, you know. But if nothing is driving our industry, we need to get with nothing and start reacting to it. That's my point.
Yeah, no, I take your point, but I suspect that the very nature of this culture will be its demise. I think it's so short-termist and it's all about short-termism that I suspect it will burn itself out fairly quickly. And if I get your point, right now in the moment, you need to gear yourself up to take advantage of it. But I suspect that by the time you've staffed up, it will have evolved into something else, Rog. And I don't know. I just think anything that is built around such a short-term view is short-term in and of itself and will ultimately morph into something else.
Well, it's the equivalent in the content world of the gig economy. Nobody's going to be employed. You'll just be like doing gigs to earn a living. I think it's the same in content. You know, it's going to be very, very short, as you say, short-lived, of the moment, snackable. Can you move on? And it'll probably get shorter and shorter and shorter. And, you know, podcasts, which 2 years ago were all super sexy, you know, I think in 2 years' time they won't exist and it'll all be done in Clubhouse or something like that. I just believe unless you're paranoid and thinking, how can this new phenomenon kill me, you're going to become a victim.
Yeah, look, you may be right. You may be right, and you make good points. And look, your radar for this stuff, I acknowledge, is better than mine for sure. But I just
let me give you some examples, as I say, to lighten it up, because let's talk a little bit about fantasy football, and the best way to talk about anything is to tell your own story.
You're not going to tell me about your fantasies now, are you? Because that's a whole different podcast.
It is, yeah. So, look, you know, I'm a Celtic fan, and whilst most people won't realise, it's been about 20 years since Celtic's been competitive, because we don't have any TV money from a small market of 5 million. So my interest in football, since we're not competitive, is very, very passing. And it's tragic. You know, one of the main, you know, pillars of my pastime enjoyment has been ripped away because of how football has been organised. That's the context. I've always liked other football as a complete neutral and enjoyed it. You know, the Iniestas of this world, the Pirlos of this world, I've looked at it as you would do going to an art gallery or something like that without any of the real passion. So this year we got invited, we being our podcast, to participate in the Fantasy Football League of the industry. And I just want to tell you what my experience is of that to let people understand. As an engagement tool, I have never seen anything like it, you know. And you know, if you really think about it, it changes completely the way you have a relationship with your sport and with your team. You know, here's a couple of examples. By the way, we're doing pretty well in this. You know, we are in the top 2% of that 8 million that I mentioned. So I can't take credit for that. It's really my son who did that.
Well, you can take a lot more credit than I can for it.
Yeah, yes. Well, even by now, I'm hardly picking the team at all. I just get an occasional, is this okay, kind of comment. But here's a funny thing, right? So I started off badly because I didn't know what I was doing, first time ever. And I said, look, you need to give me a hand here. And he got into it and did it the way that these young kids do it. And he's got a quant background and he started looking at XG and reverting to mean and did the whole thing dead proper. And the point is, by about Christmas time, we had built up a 100-point lead in this league, right? And that's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, if you think that the average score for a week is maybe 40 points, we had got 2 weeks, 2 weeks distance between somebody else. And, you know, the thing is, there's a lot of serious people that are involved in it. This is my point. You know, there's a lot of people who, you know, hold down big positions. And in work, and they, you know, your connection, conversation, water coolers conversation with them is around fantasy and your choices. You know, and you know, one guy I'm referring to here is the head of global sport for Facebook, a guy called Peter Hutton, a very, very famous guy to the listeners of this podcast. And, you know, over Christmas, we go into Christmas with a 100-point lead, and he's got a colleague who works for him called Reese Beer, who also plays fantasy. And I said to Reese, I said, look, Peter's not going to make it. That's all she wrote. It's game over. You know, it's, you know, I'm like, I like to like rub things in no. my character a little bit. Yeah. So fuck it. There's a double game week, which means that your team for that week plays two games because the fixtures are congested around Christmas. And I've not really had experience with that, but I'd thought I'd worked it out, but not as well as Peter, who actually played another thing called a bench boost, which means that the guys on your bench get points as well. And to cut a long story short, he did incredibly well and picked up 80 points out of that 100 and got right in the game. And I was devastated, right? I was devastated. And this is the funny thing about fantasy. It's the bonding thing. It's, you know, in the old days, you used to go to watch your team, you and your dad, and, yep. you know, you'd be, you know what I mean? What I'm putting down as a debate here is that fantasy is now that. So I'm furious, you know, like we had Kevin De Bruyne and like, you know, he's captain and there was a penalty and he fucking let Ryan Sterling take the penalty, who, by the way, missed it. And I was screaming at the TV. And he says to me, my son, he says, look, calm down. Peter Hutton is a fantasy veteran and a world-class player. We're still 20 points ahead. And, you know, I was thinking, what conversation are we having yeah, here?
I know.
Because, you know, like, he's kind of like calming me down because I was as if we had like lost in the semi-final in a penalty shootout. And like, you know, Grant, there's examples that you look on, and this in itself would be great content. If you just, you know how, you know, Twitch became popular because you're watching people play e-games. It's not you playing them. So it's the same thing with fantasy. I'm not saying it should be me or anything like that, but if you put cameras on people watching these games as they're going on, it is golden. You know, like there was one example, you know, Hutton's got Matip from Liverpool, you know, the defender.
Yeah.
And the way it works is defenders get points for clean sheets, but they need to have been on the field for 60 minutes. And Matip goes down in a heap about 58 minutes. Right. And, you know, immediately, and, you know, like, and of course it's a substitution that's not expected. So the guy has to warm up, needs to get his shirt on, needs to get the boots going. And we are screaming at the TV, get a move on, because if 60 goes, you know, gets to 60, gets all these points. And like, you know, there's examples of this all the time. And I just think as an engagement tool and as fun and the way that the memes, you know, when you see that the teams are announced and Cavani has not been placed in the team by Solskjaer, and you see it's just all in there. This is the sport content world there. It's fantasy, it's gamification, and it's memes.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. This the whole fantasy thing. I just don't have the bandwidth or the attention span to do it. I've got so much stuff going on. So when we put our team, I said to you, there's absolutely no way I can tell you.
I'm going to have to give you some heroin here to get you addicted.
A few hours. Mate, I don't have the time to get addicted to that. I just don't.
No, I didn't think so either, but it absolutely hooks you. I'll give you an example. Like, you know, later today, you boys, Fulham are playing West Ham.
Yeah, 12:30, you know? My time. Yep.
Yeah, so like, you know, again, coming back to Peter Hutton, because remember, he is a world-class veteran player, according to my son, and we should be happy that we're ahead of him. He made a great call a few weeks ago, picked up Antonio, you know, the West Ham player.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lucas said to me, we need to pick up Tony up. I think that's a great call, and I just blew him off. I said, he's a donkey. He's an absolute donkey, and I'm not having players like that in my team. I want world-class players like Cavani. You know, and fucking Antonio scores and scores and scores. So today, as I say, I'm not even getting consulted anymore. My son has put Antonio in, and he's captained him. He's captained them. So I'll be watching your game, something I never do, and I'll be hoping that number nine in the claret and blue bangs in a hat-trick for you, mate, and it's addictive.
What do you mean for you? You mean against me?
That's not
going to help me if he bangs a hat-trick in.
No, you are part of our team, but okay.
Well, listen, don't. All I would tell Luca is, I mean, he knows his stuff better than me, but don't put anyone from Fulham in your team at the moment. It's shocking.
I had one of your defenders at the start, but he removed them almost immediately.
Very smart. Very, very smart move. He's got we know where the brains of the family is.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's this XG analysis that, it's, you know, like when you do something, they do it well. You know what I mean? Do it well. Do the analysis. Fantastic.
Well, I've got a. I don't know. It's not an own goal. It's not a goal. It's a disallowed goal. I don't know if you saw this, Rog, earlier this week. A guy playing in the K League in Korea called Yoon Bit Garam.
Didn't see that.
Yoon, Y-O-O-N, and his surname Bit, Bit-Garam. And he plays for the Ulsan Hyundai Tigers in Korea. And this guy...
I don't know why, but Malky Mackay is the name that keeps coming into my head.
I have no idea why either.
You wouldn't know that.
I have no idea why either. But
some people will know.
But you've got to search for this goal. It's disallowed for offside. It is a fraction offside. But it is an absolutely stupendous goal. I mean, he takes it on his chest as he's spinning 360 degrees, volleys it into the roof of the net. It's a beautiful goal. Wow. And you look at it and think, oh man, if you're the ref, how do you disallow that?
It's
absolutely a piece of poetry. So look that one up. I just want to throw that one in there. Yoon Bit Garam for the Ulsan Hyundai Tigers this last week.
Perfect. We need to mention the Super Bowl, Grant.
We do, which was another one of my goals.
Well, you take that one then.
Well, no, I just Tom Brady. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable. You know, 42 years old, I think he is now. You know, to take the Buccaneers to a Super Bowl, to be the first home team ever to play in a Super Bowl. You know, I said it last time, and I was completely and utterly wrong. I said, you know, why he should retire after that Super Bowl. I mean, he has shoved those words so far down my throat, it's not even funny. And God bless him for doing so. Maybe this time, maybe you win, you become the first hometown winner of the Super Bowl, and then you retire. But I wouldn't put it past him to carry on. I mean, what a remarkable athlete he is.
Yeah, 42 is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, this year, I did get into NFL in a big way. I really followed the Packers and obviously the semi-final or whatever they call it.
Conference final, yeah.
I watched all of that, and Brady played poorly in the second half, you know. He threw three interceptions.
Yep.
I think if it wasn't for, you know, his counterpart Rodgers maybe equally kind of like getting tennis, tennis elbow, you just can't like get it over the line.
Yeah.
A little bit nervous. I don't think he would have made it. He didn't play well, but you know, it is an amazing story. Of course he's playing against his replacement, isn't he?
In that Mahomes, quarterback. Yeah. Yeah,
and he's going for two in a row, is he not?
He is. Well, his replacement in terms of the big thing, right? Mahomes is the
he's the contender, isn't he? He's the next big thing, and you know the interesting thing that I'm not sure many people in the UK have clocked, but who owns the Buccaneers? You know,
Glazers, right?
Yeah. You know, so there is a long shot bet that the Glazers win the Super Bowl and the English Premiership. How about that?
Yeah, well, that'll make all their fans around the world delighted for them.
But, I mean, if that happens, do you not think they would be entitled to say, look, you know, all you bitching fans about this, that, the next thing, you know, it's a little bit like Kraft getting caught in the massage parlour, you know, that now, kind listen, of comment.
I know that you don't think that's the case for a second, that the Glazers will be able to go, all your fans, and the fans will go, actually, you know what, Malcolm, you're right. We were wrong. You were right. We apologise.
Oh, no. I tell you what, see if United win the Premiership this year, no sweat with the Glazers. No sweat whatsoever. It's this short-termism, Grant, I mentioned with Mourinho. 6 weeks changes everything. You know, if
meme culture.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, honestly, if they bring home the Premiership, you can watch it, you know, as, you know, they win 9-0 against Southampton, who play the game with 9 men. And now all of a sudden, you know, it's back to the Busby Babes type. You know, we're a wonderful attacking team. Fans have got short-term memory. And, you know, they won't care about dividends and management fees and PIK interest and all of that that the Glazers have taken out with their LBO. They'll just say, thank you. That's wonderful. And you also did it with the Buccaneers. We've got the best owners in the world. I put my hand on the fire for that, Grant.
Well, let's see. That would be remarkable. That would be remarkable. Let's see. Let's see if that happens, Roger. I think there may be too much bad blood, but we'll see. I mean, look, they'll certainly have every right in the world to say, we were right, you were wrong. But how the fans take it, I don't know. We'll see. I've got one more for you.
A small one, but you go first.
Well, never mind. We've all got our crosses to bear. the Lions tour. Now, after the talk of it maybe being played in the UK, which, as you'll remember, I'm sure I wasn't a fan of, there is another offer on the table this week, which is absolutely delicious, and that is that Australia have volunteered, potentially, it's not all done yet, but they've volunteered to host the tour. And very generous. They have said, look, we'll just take the costs of putting it on and you can split the revenues between South Africa and the British and Irish Lions, which I think is absolutely magnificent. I mean, if that comes to pass. Now, we don't know what the situation will be in regards to fans getting there, because wherever you have a Lions tour without the Lions fans there, it's a not shadow of itself. But at least having this be a tour in a far-flung rugby nation, we'll just give it that little bit of something that it absolutely would have been stripped of had it been played in the home country. So I'm delighted that that's being mooted, and I hope it comes to pass if they can't go to South Africa.
Can I ask on this, what about the regional games? Who do the Lions play? Australian teams or South African?
They've said they'll play Australian teams. Now, yes, obviously, that's different type of rugby. I get that, but I think as a trade off, if you end up playing some of the regional Australian teams, it's still tough, uncompromising Southern Hemisphere rugby. So I think it'll.
So they're playing all these games against Australian teams, you know, during the weeks, and then all of a sudden, the warmer. Pub Act is kind of like pushed aside and South Africans appear from nowhere to play them for the tests. That's the plan.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's early days. It's just been suggested this week. So there's plenty more discussion.
I think there's a lot of thinking to do there. I'm not sure, you know, you're the great one about authenticity and everything like that. I think the idea is that, you know, you work through the rugby talent of an entire nation on the tour from regional teams and then up to the test matches. I think that's the whole point of it. You know, if you're playing regional Australians and then the South Africans turn up for the tests, it's just a hosting fee, is it not? You know?
It's a good point, but I'm thinking about the tour for the fans and the chance of actually going to Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and watching the Lions. It's an experience. I mean, it's about the whole experience, not just about the rugby, you know. I mean, if they were playing the South Africans in Ireland, England, Scotland and Wales, fine. It would be good, but it wouldn't be a Lions tour experience.
Yeah. No, it's better than the one in the UK. Yeah, I agree with that. But talking about fans and the fan experience, did you see the latest thing that came out of the Tokyo Olympics?
No, go on.
Apparently, for reasons that we all know, there is to be no cheering of athletes.
Oh, right. Okay. Well,
I mean, like, so, like, you've got a mile, you've got a 1500 meters. They're coming around the last bend. It's all tight. You've got the late sprinters coming wide on the last bend, and you're just meant to sit there and say nothing.
Well, look. If there's any country in the world that's got a chance of actually happening, it's Japan. That's the good news for them.
Possibly.
No, it depends, right? Because if it's only open to Japanese fans, you've got half a chance that actually is doable, Rog.
Okay. In terms of pulling it off, yeah. But yeah. I mean, in
no,
terms
I agree
of
with you. It's the what result a, of it. Farcical idea.
Dramatic.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Farcical like, idea. But surely for the TV coverage, they're just going to play like they've done with the Premier League. They're going to play, you know, crowd noises over the TV, and you'll hear it all. You'll as if you're sitting at home watching on the TV, which is what most people will be doing. I'm sure you're going to hear all the screaming and cheering and hollering.
Yeah, and I guess that's the bottom line, that as we get into almost 12 months of this COVID thing now, the reality is this, is that there's certain contracts that underpin the whole existence of sports, mainly broadcast contracts that need to be honoured because the money can't be paid back, and they will put them on come hell or high water.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, all this talk about this, that's where we are. Let's be honest. We are fulfilling contracts in the sports industry just now. Let's be very honest.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would disagree with you. I don't think you're gonna get much pushback on that from anybody involved in either side of that negotiation.
Yeah.
Oh, so, well, there we go. There we that's go. It for another week, my friend.
So, listen, as I said, I'll be watching your boys, hopefully, concede a barrel load to Mr. Antonio, okay? if you get some text in the next
How about I offer you this? How about Fulham win 7-6 and Antonio scores all their goals?
Perfect. You know, this is where, you know, like, so we, you know, give you an example. We look at games that are coming up, schedules, and we say, right, what do we want from this game? And what that means is, who do we have and who does Hutton have? And, you know, if he's got that, well, 0-0 works for us here. 4-3 works for us. You know, it's exactly that. If we don't have defenders in that game, then we want a barrel load of goals and we want early goals so the game opens up. So your consumption of the game of association football changes completely.
Well, listen, if you need an early goal, then you couldn't be playing anybody better than Fulham, mate. So I think you're going to be in for a pleasant surprise. We'll
no,
see.
They've done okay recently. They've been a wee bit difficult to break down, I think.
Not last week. Anyway, we'll see. All right, matey. Well, listen, all that's left is to thank you for listening to Roger and I natter away here and for your support for the podcast. Please do take a moment to rate and review us on iTunes if you get the chance. We would greatly appreciate that. You can follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR. That's the word, A-R-E. You can find me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Adieu, my old friend, or that's probably the rough.
Adieu.
Adieu. There you go, that's better. I'll see you soon.
Take care, bye.